You are listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. So listen, just a few years ago, college students were actually standing in lines to get COVID tests just to move into their dorms this time of year, if they were on campus at all. Now students are back in college classrooms almost as if COVID had never happened, even as cases are rising and the Centers for Disease Control just recommended yesterday that every 6 months, everyone 6 months and older get the newly authorized vaccine. So we have questions. And Dr. Davidson Hamer, who is a professor at Boston University School of Medicine specializing in infectious disease, is here to answer them. Welcome back, doctor.
Thanks for having me back.
It's great to have you back. And I do want to start with this back to school season for higher education, especially because depending on whose count you use, our region has anywhere between 80 and 120 colleges and universities. And one of the reasons that we wanted to talk to you is you were on the decision-making team at Boston University in the early days there. And I should note, BU holds the license for WBUR. Feels different this year than fall of 2020, doesn't it?
It's very different. I mean, I think a lot has changed. We've had a very quiet summer in terms of SARS-CoV-2 transmission.
So, doctor, your line is cutting in and out. I'm going to just have you pick up from the SARS-CoV transmission. We're going to see what we can do with your line here. Just say it again.
Sorry, I was saying it's been a quiet summer in terms of SARS-CoV-2 transmission. Although we have evidence that there's been a rise in cases in recent weeks, which is concerning. But in contrast to, can you hear me okay?
Yep, you're doing great now.
Okay, good. In contrast to, a year ago, 2 years ago, when we were doing massive testing, I think that a good part of the population has some degree of protective immunity, whether it be from vaccination, natural infection, or a combination of the two. So sort of the overall risk is less, but there's still a risk of transmission given the rising numbers.
So I'm going to play you a little bit of sound here, and I'm going to go back to the fall of 2020. My daughter, Simone Siner, is actually here at Boston University, was an incoming freshman in the fall of 2020 and went through the rituals that students did to be in person then. And here she is after her first COVID test on the day that she moved into her dorm.
They had everyone single file. I went in, they told me all the information. I did the test, I went out, gave them the test, and I'll hear back within 48 hours.
And they were going to be doing that testing here at Boston University 3 times a week, waiting for vaccines that they were all going to have to take. We all did. This year, no testing, not even a requirement for incoming freshmen to get vaccinated. Dr. Hamer, as the university made those changes in policy, both the key decision factors, right? One of them I think I hear from you is accumulated immunity, right? But what are the other key decision factors happening at universities that allow for that much change in this period of time? Do you understand my question?
I do. I mean, it's a difficult question to answer. I think there's several things that have happened. I mean, one is we've learned to live with the COVID, there have been flares where there have been really large outbreaks. Delta, Omicron. We've only really had, I'd say, waves or ripples rather than massive waves in the last 6 months or so. And so, we're thinking that this may be leading towards a more seasonal transmission epidemiology. But in any case, it's still there, and students represent a pool that could be infected. As we've discussed in the past, the risk for young, healthy individuals of this disease is relatively low. I mean, they're not likely to be hospitalized. Because many have pre-existing immunity from the vaccine or natural infection, their risk of long COVID is greatly reduced. So I think that overall, there's just less concern about the potential implications. On the other hand, students that have weaker immune systems or conditions that predispose them to severe disease, and certainly faculty and staff that do, need to be cautious. I think it might be worth talking about how, what can be done to try and reduce the risk for those individuals.
So talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Well, so the biggest, most exciting thing is that in just yesterday, the FDA has approved two new vaccine formulations that are going to be coming available almost, immediately from two of the vaccine producers that produce the messenger RNA vaccines. And these are targeting a variant that had been circulating and still is circulating, although now we're really in subvariants of that. It's called XBB 1.5. And those vaccines should help in particular for people that are at higher risk for disease complications, for more severe disease and hospitalization. And so I think that anyone who has any degree of concern should consider being vaccinated. The protection, as we know from a lot of studies that have been done in the last 2 years, the greatest degree of protection against symptomatic infection is going to be for probably 3 months or so, or maybe a little longer after the vaccine booster. But the protection for those at higher risk against severe disease and hospitalization should last longer than that. In addition to that, I think personal protective measures are going to be important. And the biggest one is if you're worried about getting COVID, you should wear a mask in crowded public places with poor ventilation. So I've actually taken to wearing a mask on the subways, the metro, the T, that is, and buses, especially if they're really crowded. If there's very few people on the bus and the windows are open, I'm not too worried. There's going to be good ventilation. But if they're packed, and we've been having some problems with our T system recently that are leading to more congestion, then, contexts like that or an indoor arena where there are a lot of people and poor air circulation, those are settings where there's going to be a high risk for potentially for transmission. So I think if you're risk averse, you should wear a mask in those contexts.
So we're talking with Dr. David Hamer, who's a professor at Boston University's School of Medicine here on Radio Boston. You did mention these two new vaccines produced by familiar players, Pfizer and Cambridge-based Moderna, approved by the FDA yesterday. The CDC says, listen, anybody who's age 6 months or older, we actually recommend you go ahead and get these. Local pharmacies like CVS already scheduling next week for them to be available. I actually would like to move into something that for our listeners, Dr. Hamer, is going to feel a little bit more like an ask the doctors, because there's a whole new set of questions now that some of what you just said and that those new shots raise. So I think my first question is, does it matter which one of those you get?
I think as of right now, there's probably very little difference between the two of them. I mean, they're targeting the same subvariant XBB 1.5, which is sort of a distant cousin of Omicron, and so they I don't know whether they have the exact same concentration of messenger RNA, because the initial vaccines actually were slightly different in that regard. But as of right now, I don't think there's any reason to think that one will be any better or worse than the other.
So to this point about variants, we just had a mini COVID outbreak here in Boston. I will admit on air, I fell victim to it at the beginning of August. Dr. Ashish Jha, we talked with him recently, former head of the White House's COVID response. He said he's not too worried about this variant, although there had been some concerns about it. Here he is.
If one of them is really different, if it will escape our vaccines, if it's make our treatments not effective, that will be the moment we need to sound the alarm and say we've got a real problem. EG5 is not that.
And as I understand it, there's a reasonable level of confidence that both these Pfizer and Moderna products that were approved this week, Dr. Hamer, pretty much have captured the variants that have been causing the recent, I don't know what you want to call it, spike, surge, uptick in cases.
Yes, and EG.5 is one that has been gradually rising. There's a couple others, and they're all really subvariants of XBB 1.5. The vaccine's neutralizing antibodies, sort of the immunity that it induces, appears at least in lab models to neutralize those strains of the vaccine. And even though they are sort of novel in that they have a lot more mutations, They aren't different enough that they're likely to cause a massive outbreak. And just, I mean, one additional thing is if you look back to when Delta came, and then in particular when Omicron came in, it was so different that it just exploded. And within weeks, we had a transition from almost no Omicron to nearly 90% or more of samples being sequenced were Omicron. We're not seeing that with EG5 or some of the other variants. They're sort of slowly gaining a little prominence and then they fade away. So none of them have been different enough that they're able to cause a large-scale outbreak.
Is there any reason that one cannot get one of these shots alongside a flu shot? It is that time of year with strong encouragement by, you know, public health professionals, by the state, to get the flu shot too.
No. I mean, in fact, it's you know, probably a good idea to have the two together. If, you know, they're you may feel a little, you know, a few more side effects having both together in terms of, you know, how you your sore arm and how you feel the next day. But there's no reason not to do them. And you know, the next couple months are going to be an important time for transmission of these diseases. I mean, influenza usually starts a little bit later. We, as I mentioned, you know, we have had a sort of a slight uptick in COVID. And then the third one, which is a completely different, is respiratory syncytial virus, RSV. And that there's evidence that that's starting to circulate. But that's really a much greater risk for very young children, especially the first year or two of life, and then older adults.
So who is recommended and can receive the RSV vaccine right now?
The RSV vaccine is recommended for sort of older adults. I don't know if it's 60 or 65 for the cutoff. I think it's 60. And basically, I think it's recommended for all older adults. Although the reality is those that, you know, are likely to have weaker immune systems or more medical conditions are going to be at higher risk for having that. And I'd say in particular adults over the age of 70. The pediatric formulation, well, there's not really a pediatric formulation. There's a monoclonal antibody that's become available for children that are in particular that are premature, that are at high risk for RSV. During the RSV season, there's also a version that can be given during pregnancy to induce immunity to protect the newborn baby. And that I think is just approved also. But I think the big one is really for older adults is to consider having the RSV vaccine.
And do you recommend in our last 20 seconds or so, as soon as possible on all of these, or is there some pacing?
You know, I think that the RSV soon, it should, I mean, there's some evidence in parts of the country that RSV is starting to increase. The COVID booster, you know, I think for higher risk individuals, probably would be a good idea to have that booster soon. A lot of people have been waiting to have their booster because it's been a while. So sooner for that. Influenza, you know, I think it could wait a month or two.
All right. Dr. Davidson Hamer, professor, Boston University's School of Medicine, specialist in infectious disease. It's been a while. Thank you so much for joining us again here on Radio Boston.
My pleasure. Take care.